If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
New York's MTA gave a presentation this week to attempt to explain the subway system's recent fall in ridership. They shut off the lights in the auditorium, cranked the heat up to 115, peed on the floor, and said, "That's pretty much it."
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to comedian, writer, and director Bo Burnham. Plus, Bo keeps the conversation going backstage at Studio AG. Then, as a bonus, late-night warm-up comedian Ryan Reese interviews his friend, comic Nemish Patel, followed by Nemish's stand-up set live on Late Night. But first, a closer look.
As President Trump's legal and political troubles continue to mount, he's stepping up his war on the press and lying to his supporters about his economic agenda. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Just this week, the White House has been hit with a secret tape recorded by Trump's ex-lawyer and is racing to meet a court deadline to reunite the migrant families they separated at the border. And on top of all that, it was reported today that special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe is zeroing in on Trump's use of social media.
Breaking news now in the special counsel Russia meddling investigation. The New York Times just posting a story quoting sources saying the special counsel Robert Mueller and his team of prosecutors looking at the president's tweets. The special counsel Robert S. Mueller is scrutinizing tweets and negative statements from the president about Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the former FBI Director James B. Comey.
That's right. Law enforcement has to look at Trump's tweets. So I guess they bring in a blood spatter expert, but for words? Can you make any sense of it? I've seen all these words before, just never in this order. So with his legal problems mounting, the White House decided that the best response is to try to stop reporters from asking President Trump questions. Today, for example, Trump flew to Iowa. Now, usually, when Trump flies somewhere, he takes a helicopter from the White House to Air Force One, which means he has to walk by reporters on the White House lawn. And that usually gets him in trouble. I mean, look at him. Even the way he walks up to reporters makes him look guilty. Okay, I can explain. But today, Trump avoided the press by taking a motorcade, and the reason they gave was very odd. The White House cited bad weather as the reason for Trump taking the motorcade instead of the chopper, with fog specifically to blame. And for a look at that fog, here's a photo a White House reporter snapped of the Washington sky this morning. He's even lying about the weather now. We're like a day away from Trump literally pissing on our leg and telling us it's raining. This isn't even the first time this week Trump has tried to avoid tough questions from reporters. Yesterday, his White House literally barred CNN reporter Caitlin Collins from a White House event just for asking tough questions.
CNN White House correspondent Caitlin Collins was banned from a late afternoon press event because the White House simply didn't like the questions she had asked the president earlier in the day.
CNN immediately disputed that assertion, releasing a statement saying this: just because the White House is uncomfortable with a question regarding the news of the day doesn't mean the question isn't relevant and shouldn't be asked.
Hey, man, you can't just ban a reporter for asking questions that make you uncomfortable. For one thing, every question makes you uncomfortable. When reporters ask you questions, you literally hug yourself. So what were these questions that made Trump so mad? Here's a clip of the exchange which included a question about Trump's decision to invite Vladimir Putin to the White House.
Did Michael Cohen betray you, Mr. President?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.
Mr. President.
Thank you, everybody.
Mr. President, are you worried about what Michael Cohen is going to say to prosecutors?
Let's keep going.
Are you worried about what is on the other tapes, Mr. President?
Thank you all. Let's keep going. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Why has Vladimir Putin not accepted your invitation?
Oh, yeah, it was definitely that last one. Oh, that last one was the one that made him unhappy, because Trump is probably refreshing his Evite page every 5 minutes. Okay, I'm going to check again. I'm just going to check again. What time is it in Russia? Of course, it's a relevant question. Trump is desperate to get Putin to like him, as he's made clear many times. And yet, in his speeches, he keeps repeating all the empty slogans Republicans have been parroting for years about putting America first, as he did yet again on Tuesday during a speech to the VFW.
We don't apologize for America anymore. We stand up for America. We stand up for the patriots who defend America. And we stand up for our national anthem. We're putting America first again.
He sounds like he's at a truck stop just absentmindedly reading all the bumper stickers for sale. We stand up for America. We're putting America first again. My other car is your sister. Oh, that's funny. This is a good one. Put this on Air Force One. Of course, it was Trump himself who went to Helsinki last week and apologized for America while standing next to Vladimir Putin, who returned the favor by admitting to reporters that he wanted Trump to win.
President Putin, did you want President Trump to win the election, and did you direct any of your officials to help him do that?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Because he talked about bringing the U.S.-Russia relationship back to normal.
Back to normal? How can you bring something back to a place you've never been? Of all the things you could say about Trump, one thing you can't say is that he's normal. He can't even stand normal. He puffs out his chest like a duck during a mating ritual. Trump is a classic New York weirdo. If he weren't president, he'd be the dude in Central Park feeding pigeons and naming them after the 1986 New York Mets.
I call this one Daryl and this one's Mookie. They're my friends.
But this is a perfect example of how Trump tries to rewrite a narrative in the face of clear-cut evidence. He just tells his supporters not to believe that evidence, as he did during that same speech on Tuesday when he told them not to trust what they see on the news. Trump was talking specifically about a segment he saw on NBC about the impact his trade tariffs are having on farmers.
Don't believe the crap you see from these people, the fake news. I saw a piece on NBC. It was heart-throbbing. They were interviewing people. They probably go through 20, and then they pick the one that sounds like the worst. But they went through a group of people. In fact, I wanted to say, I got to do something about this Trump. Terrible. And that piece was done by the lobbyists and by the people that they hire. It was a total setup. This country is doing better than it's ever done before economically. And just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
What you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening. Trump is like a Jedi.
These are not the droids you're looking for.
Yeah, no, those are my droids. Get out of here. Also, just to make sure we all heard it, can we go back to the start of that clip for a second?
I saw a piece on NBC. It was heart-throbbing.
Heart-throbbing? Why are you so weird, dude?
It was so heart-throbbing, totally butt-wrenching. I have to say, I was thumbstruck.
It's very clear you don't know what heart-throb means. Were you mad at the piece, or were you sexually attracted to it?
I was watching NBC. It was heart-throbbing. Our farmers are so sexy.
All Trump has left is to tell you not to trust your own eyes and ears, because if you do, you'll see very clearly he's lying. And his tariffs are a perfect example. Trump wants you to think they're working, but now even his own government is admitting that the tariffs are hurting farmers. And as a result, Trump wants to bail them out.
The U.S. Agriculture Department is providing $12 billion in emergency assistance to farmers hard hit by retaliatory tariffs.
That's right. Trump's tariffs are going so well, his government has to spend $12 billion to bail out farmers. That's like a burglar stealing your TV, selling it, and using the money to buy you a TV. But this perfectly encapsulates the absurdity of Trump's economic policies and the Republican response to those policies. Tennessee Senator Bob Corker put it this way: you have a terrible policy that sends farmers to the poorhouse, and then you put them on welfare and we borrow the money from other countries. It's hard to believe there isn't an outright revolt right now in Congress. Dude, you're in Congress. This is like hearing someone yell, "The Mets suck," and realizing it's coming from the shortstop. I think Trump is aware that his tariffs are hurting farmers because today he held a roundtable event in Iowa and debuted a new hat he made just for the farmers in attendance.
And I have to say, because we have a lot of farmers in this place, we had this hat made up. Look at that. It's the John Deere colors, actually. But make our farmers great again. Isn't that great? Make our...
So if you're screwed by Trump's policies, good news. At least you're going to get a hat. If Trump ever causes a nuclear apocalypse, at least we know what the zombies will wear. So if tariffs aren't the answer, then what is? Well, Democrats, led in part by rising stars like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who describes herself as a democratic socialist, are beginning to rally around ideas like free public college or Medicare for all. But as a result, right-wing pundits are absolutely losing their minds.
Socialist superstars Bernie Sanders and, yeah, the new rock star Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez were in Kansas on Friday pushing their socialist, liberal, left-wing agenda.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a product of a Marxist, socialist, anti-American ideology.
I mean, we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about she will not rest until there is free education for all students.
We've got this rising star socialist, Alexandria Cortez, saying capitalism won't work. I'll tell you, I don't know if that's the way to power. Socialists treat the Constitution like a build-your-own, all-you-can-eat buffet salad.
They're trying to make democratic socialism sound scary by comparing it to an all-you-can-eat buffet. In America. If the socialists win, they'll turn this country into one big golden corral. Okay. But by far, the best example of the right-wing freakout over the rise of democratic socialism came from a conservative writer who attended a rally held by Ocasio-Cortez and described her experience to Fox News.
So based upon what you saw, why are people drawn to this message?
Well, I was listening to them talk. They say things, I mean, they talk about things that everybody wants, especially like if you're a parent. They talk about education for your kids, health care for your kids, the things that you want. And, you know, if you're not really paying attention to how they're going to pay for it or, you know, the rest of that, it's easy to fall into that trap and say, my kids deserve this.
That is terrifying. What kind of a demented far-left zealot would try to indoctrinate innocent Americans with radical ideas like health care for kids? I am outraged. I mean, what's next? A jobs guarantee? A living wage? Oh, free hats? Trump's economic policies are only hurting the people he promised to help. Meanwhile, Democrats are rallying around ideas like Medicare for all. And all conservatives can do is whine about it. They think it's heartbreaking when in reality it's
heart throbbing.
This has been a closer look. Our guest is a very funny comedian, and he's written and directed his first film, Eighth Grade, which is in select cities now and nationwide on August 3rd. Please welcome to the show, Bo Burnham, everyone. How are you?
Pretty good, Seth. Thanks
for
having me.
I'm really happy to have you. This
Appreciate
is a special film. You made a really special film.
Thank
Congratulations.
You. Appreciate it.
The clip actually, I feel like, shows off something that I really loved about this movie, which is the eighth graders, it strikes me that they talk the way eighth graders talk.
Right.
Was that very important to get the truth of that right for you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of movies about teenagers, it feels like the
the teenagers speak with an ability that is suspiciously similar to a screenwriter's ability to speak, you know? Yeah. And it's always like, in order for a young character to be worthy of love, they need to be some, like, young poet laureate that's in perfect command of their narrative. And I wanted to have a story about a kid that spoke how kids speak, which is like you just drank a glass of milk and you're like, you know? So that was the movie. How do you write someone that can't speak? How do you dress someone that can't dress? Because you're in eighth grade and you're a mess.
You, I've always, I really liked about your stand-up that it was very honest, but it was very much from your perspective. I feel like you told a really honest story here from a different person's perspective, obviously. Right. Did you find that challenging, or was it refreshing for you to tell it from someone else's viewpoint?
It was nice. I was tired of my head and my, are you tired of your head?
I do get tired of it sometimes, yeah.
We aren't tired of his head, right?
Oh, thank you. I think some people are. I
could have phrased it differently. Yeah. I wanted to make a story that didn't feel nostalgic and didn't feel like a memory. Mm-hmm. You know, I was never a 13-year-old girl. I was also never 13 now. And both of those things lend themselves to a specific experience. So it being a girl, I had to sort of walk her experience with her for the first time, which is what I wanted the movie to feel like.
You obviously were aided by an incredible cast, a young cast.
Yes.
Was it, what were the challenges of working with actors that age?
Yeah, you get a lot. Before you work with kids, everyone's like, oh my God, don't work with kids. They're the worst. And I found the adults to be way more difficult. Like, when you work with an adult, you're like, just can you stand over there? And they're going, is my light okay? Like, is this all right on me? And with a kid, you're going, like, spit in your hand. And they're going, which hand?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's very, they're just, kids are, like, so ready to imagine. Adult actors need, like, a 3-hour ice bath to get to the point where, like, kids are just already there, ready to pretend. Yeah.
This movie also, I feel like, does a really nice job of examining the relationship children that age have with social media. But also, I feel like adults these days look down on that relationship, and it's very unfair to say that 13-year-olds are the only ones who have this connection.
Oh, the worst people on the internet by far are 30-year-olds. Like, the absolutely the most embarrassing people. Because I was looking at the internet thinking, why are we all acting like 8th graders on the internet? So the 8th graders are actually the only ones acting their own age. So it's really my friends that are my age and close to that, yeah, why not?
Yeah,
come on.
Age-appropriate behavior, yeah.
I think we're going through an eighth grade moment as a culture. It feels like the country is sort of functioning at an eighth grade level right now. So
yeah.
it was a good way to talk about it.
You know, I was talking with a few of the other people who saw the movie about how you watch it and you think, oh, my God, that's so true. You know, kids wake up in the morning, the first thing they do is look at their phone, and then we all realize the night after we watched the film that we all woke up the next morning and looked at our phones.
Yeah, of course.
Like, we're no better.
Well, that's the thing, is when I feel like the internet's talked about, it's talked by, like, hovery helicopter people that are commenting on it. I'm in it. I feel as much connected to it emotionally as she does. So this isn't a Forrest movie. This is within it, trying to talk about it within it. I have no authority on the current moment. I'm very confused by the internet. I have no idea where it's going. It's a prison, and it's liberating, and we're stimulated, and we're numb, and we're connected, and we're lonely. So the movie's just like a shrug. And why can't we see everything?
Yeah.
I'm not selling it very
no,
well.
No, that's when I saw...
Yeah.
When I saw on the poster the quote that said it was a shrug,
yeah.
I couldn't get there.
Come on, two thumbs sideways.
But you mentioned that you're not 13 now. Obviously, I'm not 13 now, and when I was 13, it was even farther away from now than you. But I feel like you, this is, and the math obviously will go to the lower third, but you know, I feel like there is that, being 13, there are parts of it that no matter what era you live in are the same.
Right.
And watching it, you just grab the terror. And I should point out there are, like, really lovely, uplifting moments in this film. But, like, you know, being 13 is a terrifying thing to be.
Yeah, your body's exploding. Your your mind is exploding. Yeah, it's awful. But it's also hopeful. It's just the movie, I hope, is what 13 is, which is scary and weird and fun and horrifying and help me and yay, you know?
Yeah.
So.
But it's also an age where, you know, which is really nice in the storytelling as well, where you think a lot about who you are.
Mm.
One of the things that is in the film is these are eighth graders who made time capsules when they were sixth graders.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing to even look at how kids perceive themselves 2 years earlier. This
right.
is something that you happened in your life. You had a time capsule.
I wrote a letter to myself. I didn't know this until after I filmed the movie. My mother found this thing and showed it to me, that I had written a letter in sixth grade to my senior year self.
And you just forgot? By the time you were a senior, you didn't care about sixth grade Beau anymore.
I don't know. It was just buried deep enough where I think it came out in the script without me knowing. But yeah, it's horrifying.
So there are, first of all, there's a letter. This is a letter you wrote to yourself. Do you mind reading sixth grade?
Yay. My handwriting was better. Okay. Hey, older Beau. How are things going? Right now, I am 5'4 with blonde hair and blue eyes and very scared of heights. Which, I would get much taller, so the fear would grow. Okay. The Patriots won the Super Bowl this year, but I was so sick, I fell asleep at halftime, frowny face. Now, that, I am performing my love of sports to myself. I was so scared of my masculinity being a Boston kid. I am performing the fact that I like sports to my future self. It's really, truly pathetic. I hope you've been in some commercials or maybe even movies. Are you going to Duke to play basketball? No. No, very not. Quite the opposite, actually. I was going to Tisch for experimental theater, which is the exact opposite of that actual thing.
Yeah, they,
Okay. If that's not, it's okay. And then I signed it, your friend and self, Beau.
Oh, that's very nice.
The past.
This is really great, because this is something that was in your time capsule, and I think it shows a real range of interests. Yeah. There is, it seems to be some sort of nature walk. J-Lo.
J-Lo, timeless.
And by the way, truly timeless.
And it is her birthday today, everybody, for real.
Happy birthday, J-Lo.
Looking as good as ever. Better.
I think any, for real, any time capsule a photo of J-Lo is in is like, looks exactly the same.
Oh, yeah, she's Benjamin Button. Is that the female?
And that's your brother.
That's my brother picking his nose, and it says, is your brother still a moron?
It's really great. This is another one. What do we got here?
This is 47. That's my dad's football number. Once again, performative masculinity. I gotta get woke, baby. And then Nature's Classroom, turtle dissection. Ew. What, dissection? Am I European? Dissection. whatever.
Yeah. I like, it's really interesting that you realize so much of time capsules is just reminding older you that happened, because you're telling the older you stuff that they were there for.
Yeah. And also pretending. I mean, when you read diaries of yourself, you know what I mean? Diaries are apparently, like, private. But when you read them, you're going, why am I performing my own depth to myself?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, oh, today I was this. And, like, it's like all these words of the day. So I just think there's even a sense of performing yourself to yourself at that age. You're even trying to trick yourself into convincing that you're
something. Well, and again, this is an element of the film is this is a girl who does, videos every day and talks. And you know, this is how the film starts. And it's interesting, her performative nature, because she is projecting confidence that obviously she doesn't have.
Yeah, and people see that just as a bad thing. Like, oh, kids are so fake online. But the version of, like, trying to speak out loud and maybe become what you say you may be is beautiful. And, like, I do actually think that who we hope we might be is a more vulnerable truth than who we're scared we might be. I think people are way quicker to admit their fears than their hopes. So a little kid online lying about their life, trying to be cool, I think is beautiful and not just fake and not just superficial.
That's a wonderful sentiment, and you made a wonderful film. And thank you so much for being here, man. Such
thanks,
a pleasure.
Seth, appreciate it.
Bo Burnham, everybody. 8th grade is in select cities now and nationwide on August 3rd.
Hi, this is Henry. I'm here with Bo Burnham, writer, director of this incredible film, 8th Grade, which you were just talking to Seth about. This was your first directing debut for a film, but you directed comedy specials before. And I was wondering what it's like to direct a comedy special and how you use that skill for your major motion picture.
Well, appreciate it, Henry. Thanks for having me.
It's such a good movie.
Hell, appreciate it. Like, stand-up specials are definitely not a director's medium. You know what I mean? You just, like, kind of are supposed to serve the person on screen, which is a very good lesson to learn, just to serve the person that you're filming. And also, like, you have to make one look. It's all about really setting one look, but having a look that feels versatile and can be versatile and can be looked at for an hour without being sore. So that's a good lesson, just to learn how to, like, get as much as you can out of a single location.
Right. And, well, I should have mentioned, one of the people you directed two, right? Gerard Carmichael and Chris Rock.
Yeah.
What is it like directing comedians of that kind of stature?
You know, it's, you know, Gerard's a good friend of mine. So that was, you know, very sort of comfortable right away. And Chris is just a very down to earth, humble person that was like, trusted me at least with the look of it to a degree that terrified me at first.
Yeah,
I was
sure.
Like, oh, bro. But also like truly the bar that you have to leap over for comedy specials, at least aesthetically, is pretty low.
Sure.
So you don't have to do much to look like you made an effort. But yeah, it was amazing. I mean, Chris especially is just like such a hardworking, incredibly determined person for a legend. You know what I mean? It's
yeah, yeah.
Very inspiring to see a legend who applies himself so much.
Right.
And then Gerard, it was like so special because it was like, I'm such a fan of him, and I like truly love him as a person that I felt like,
yeah,
I definitely felt the burden of wanting to represent what I felt
fantastic
about him.
Yeah. So then you go to this movie, and I'm wondering how, looking back on the process, directing, also you wrote it, writing and directing a movie was different than you expected going in.
It was, you know, it's weird. It's like I expected it to be different. So
oh,
it was,
sure.
It was different. So like I expected it to be impossible and a challenge, and it wasn't impossible uh-huh. and a challenge. So in a certain way, it like was exactly what I thought it was going to be, in that I had no idea what it was going to be. You know, I kind of
right,
expected
right.
not to know. But no, it just, it really is collaborative. It's so collaborative. I mean, that's really what makes it so different than all the other processes. I mean, stand-up directing is the one thing, but doing stand-up is just so insular and so singular. So it was really nice to be able to rely on other people and work with other people.
Yeah. You know, a lot of this movie is about social media and the internet. You were discovered on YouTube when you were about 16.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like going back and revisiting YouTube now?
Oh, I've been on YouTube the whole time, you know, as
sure,
a viewer.
Sure.
As a viewer. So, like,
yeah.
I really, it's like, I love...
It'd be funny if you hadn't looked at a YouTube video
since I was 16 years.
Yeah, exactly. You swore off of it.
Yeah. But it was like...
So revisiting this time capsule
yeah,
of YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah. I blew dust off my old keyboard.
Yeah.
Okay. Turn on my Dell. What a sound I made. Yeah, it was good. It was... I don't know. I know. I feel like I've had an evolving relationship with it the entire time. So I was just trying to do justice to the constant relationship I have with the internet.
Uh-huh.
I've been keeping my eye on like the way people have been expressing themselves on the internet for a long time, and I've always had a focus on people that weren't getting attention, people that
yeah.
weren't going viral, because viral people are not interesting.
Right. What is particularly interesting to you about how people present themselves on the internet, which is a major piece of this film?
Well, it's just that like it is so. There's nothing in the way of it. It's so unprocessed. It really is a person filming themselves, just giving them to you. So like. It can be, if you dig a little past the surface, the most genuine, the most human medium we have.
Yeah.
Because it really is like no studio, no network, no nothing. It really is just person to person sharing something. And that's just incredible. It's beautiful. So any falsity, any performance in
yeah.
the thing is actually from that person. So it's meaningful. Mm-hmm. As opposed to when you see falsity in popular media or you know, too much light or fakeness. You don't know where to trace the fakeness to. Is this the advertisers talking? Is this the studio talking? Is this the writer talking? Is this the performer in the moment talking?
Yeah.
It's just so much more traceable.
And you must have been super aware of that as you made a real movie where there are a lot of different stakeholders
exactly.
involved. Yeah.
Exactly. So it had to be built into the script, you know,
yeah.
and it had to be even built into the budget. You know what I mean? To like
yeah,
do
yeah.
something like that where it felt like, yeah, we can't have, you know, a bunch of famous kids in this, because that plays against the exact thing we're doing.
Right.
Yeah, so exactly.
It's really interesting to see actors, young actors that we haven't seen before. It
yes.
just it gives the movie something different.
Yes, that's I think, you know, actors even, I think actors' job is to disappear. It's very strange,
yeah,
but it doesn't seem to be. It's like
right.
a boom operator's job is to not be seen. Same with an actor.
Yeah. Well, again, congratulations on the film.
Appreciate it, man.
It's just I was saying earlier, I think you've cursed yourself.
Oh,
you made such a good first film. I don't know how you're going to top it, but I'm looking forward to seeing what you're going to try.
Don't call sophomore slump for nothing, baby.
That's right. Then you'll rebound after that.
Yeah, junior jamboree.
The junior jamboree. Looking forward to it.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Bo.
Thanks.
Ryan Reese, audience warrant comedian for Late Night with Seth Meyers, here with Nimesh Patel, who's about to make his debut on network TV doing stand-up. How do you feel, buddy?
Great. Excited.
This is your network debut. How many years have you been doing comedy?
9 years now. This is 9 years coming up in August, actually.
Wow.
So right before my 9-year anniversary.
9 years in comedy. And you're one of those comedians that actually had a pretty stable career path before you got into stand-up comedy, or at least you went to Stern?
Yeah, I went to NYU for a degree in finance, graduated, did not get a traditional sort of banking job right out of school. Had like a job for about a year. or bounced around a bunch of jobs for about a year, started comedy because I was kind of bored, but also like looking at, for some creative outlet, and got on stage August 19th, 2009. And
yeah, you had, I'm just saying, you had, you're one of those guys that actually had like life options and you gambled it all. Now it's paying off.
Yeah. I mean, I hedged for a minute.
Yeah.
I hedged for about, I think this is probably my second or third year of just doing comedy full time. I think I started 2016. I started comedy full time, January, but before that, day job, 9 to 5, almost 9 to 8, kind of just like working in random finance jobs. Not like, not the people that are making like millions of bucks or anything like that.
No, no, but you're also an accomplished comedy writer. You've written for the Oscars.
Yeah.
You've also written for SNL.
Yes.
Now it's all coming together.
Yeah. I mean, this is my, I feel like, a late night spot feels like, all right, this guy is a comedian. You know what I mean? Like, it's something about it, just doing it. It's just like, okay, cool. Now, like, this will be the first thing that comes up when you Google.
How many times did you run this set this week?
Honestly, I tried to keep it minimal. I did it maybe once or twice a night, but it was always on top of, it was always just the beginning of, like, a longer set. Just because I didn't want to lose the sort of natural vibe to it, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to seem too rehearsed when I do anything.
You want to be in the moment.
Yeah, I kind of want to just feel like, and which is hard to do when you're in front of cameras and there's millions of people watching. But
and Seth Meyers is sitting right behind you.
And Seth is right there, you know. But yeah, I just wanted to feel like as sort of natural as possible. So I didn't. I had the option, obviously, because you know you can run at the Cellar because they're very kind there when it's time to do something like this, like.
Both me and Nimesh work at the Comedy Cellar where he's been running the set all week. What are you timing out the set at now?
Honestly, I think it's like 4:49, 4:50. Like, but with the laughs and stuff, it's like hard to place. Like, if people laugh a lot, which I hope they do, it's going to be over. And if they don't, then it's going to be under. So
about 2.5 minutes.
Yeah, it's just like, I remember one time I did an audition for something and I timed it to be like 5 minutes. And I was auditioning. When the audition happened, it was crickets. And so at one point on stage, I was like, well, I probably shouldn't have planned laugh time into this set.
You were just pausing for like applause breaks that weren't there.
It was just brutal. It was like sweat dripping down my nose. It was just bad, man. But I feel like I've got enough leeway.
You're seasoned. You're 9 years in in August. You've got this down.
Yeah, I know when this, and they got a clock there, which is, I didn't know they would have. So I'll be cool with it. I'll know if I need to speed up or cut something on the fly or whatever. So,
well, you're a professional comedian. You know how to make adjustments on the move.
Yeah. Hopefully. We'll see. Oh, just stammer up there.
How much thought did you put into the material you chose?
Honestly, it was a lot of feedback from my agents and my manager. Because, like, doing comedy 9 years, it feels like getting a late night spot now feels like, all right, so at some point, I was doing something wrong because this is not my first attempt at getting a late night spot, right? But it's like, then you look at my agent said something, whatever your first thing is you put out, whatever anyone, the first thing that you see is got to establish who you are. Like normally you've seen my stand-up, like I like to just talk about a lot of stuff going on in the world or like a big picture on like social issues or whatever, but it's hard to talk about that kind of stuff if people don't know who the hell this guy is. And so when I was crafting this set, it was like, all right, how do I establish who I am and still be able to talk and still like give you a hint that there's more than just this superficial thing on in comedy for me, at least, you know? So I was like, how do I structure, what jokes do I pick to tell you A, who I am, and then B, like, okay, these are the kind of jokes I would be telling if I had an hour to do something. You know what I mean?
Okay, well, this is exciting. You're actually moments away from your network debut. I want to give you some time to get ready for it. Congratulations, buddy.
Thank you, brother. It's going to be awesome, man. Thank you so much, man.
All right, thanks, bud.
Thank you.
Our guest is a very funny comedian and writer for Saturday Night Live. Please give it up for Nimesh Patel.
Hello. Hi. Okay. Yeah, I'm Nimesh Patel. I'm the number one Google result if you Google Nimesh Patel. I only found this out when my mom called me and then she Googled me. And she said, Nimesh, you're the number one Google result if you Google Nimesh Patel. I said, you damn right. And then she said, every other Nimesh Patel is a doctor. Where'd I go wrong? And then she hung up the phone. So, she's cool. I love my parents. I go to see them time to time. I went home last weekend to see my mom and my dad. My mom picks me up from the bus stop, but she'll never go straight home. There's always like 40 errands between me and the food that's waiting for me. And this last time I went home, my mom picks me up. She says, Nimesh, I have to go to the bank. It's going to be 2 minutes. I said, this again? All right, let's go to the bank. Go to the bank. I'm sitting in the car for 20 minutes. I call my mom. I said, Mom, I hope this is a hostage situation. Otherwise, you're wasting my time. She said, Nimesh, how old are you? I said, 32. She said, that's many of my years. You wasted. Then she hung up again. So, it's a good burn. I went to see my dad because it was his birthday. And I got him a gym membership for his birthday. And I took him to the gym. And I discovered he's the kind of guy that will follow around someone who's hired a personal trainer and then just do those exercises. That's the best guy on the planet. My parents are Indian, if you can't tell, if you're stupid or something. It's a weird time to be an Indian person in this country, I'll tell you that much. Because it feels like at any moment, black and white people are about to go to war, and Indians are going to have to choose. I don't know what side to be on, quite frankly. It feels like mom and dad are getting divorced, you know? And dad's really cool, but mom's got all the stuff, so. I just saw this movie that defines race relations real well. I saw Get Out. You guys seen it? It's great. It's a phenomenal movie. If you haven't seen it, it's a horror movie. It's about a black guy that goes to see his white girlfriend's parents. And they end up being mad white. Like crazy white. It's a horror movie. It's the most successful horror movie written and directed by a black director. You watch that horror movie, then you watch a white horror movie like Paranormal Activity, and you realize the difference in the genres. Like, real subtle. In a black horror movie, the monster is racism. In a white horror movie, the monster is a house you could just leave. We're not giving up on this mortgage, Tabitha. Not today. I saw the movie with my quite white girlfriend, and then we went to see her parents the next day, and I was very suspicious. I've been with my girlfriend for about 4 years now, so we fight in public. That's all that means. I've discovered that the best place to have an argument with your girlfriend is in the back of an Uber, because you have a judge. And he usually goes with whoever ordered the car. If my girl and I are fighting, I will call an Uber to nowhere and I'll text the driver like, hey man, you better be on my side, bro. There's some stars riding on this one for you. My girl and I the other night are on the back of the Uber and we're arguing and the driver is dead quiet. And then we get to our destination. My girl gets out, driver turns around and looks at me and says, hey man, I agree with you. Not enough stars for that review. I wrote Uber a letter. So I've never taken a Lyft or a cab ever again. I want this specific Muhammad guy every time. Because look, sometimes you need a stereotype to be true, okay? My Muslim friends, great guys. But when you're fighting with your girlfriend, you want the opinion of that one Middle Eastern guy that doesn't believe in women's rights on your side. You guys got tense, but I'm not wrong. It's wrong, but I'm not wrong. Oh, you think I should do the dishes? Let's see what this dude from Qatar has to say. All right, thank you very much. I'm Nimesh.
Nimesh Patel, everybody!
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Once upon a beat.
Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.